History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. That's what we've learned. If we're just willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then exercise enough patience to allow some eye-opening responses to rise to the surface, we might just end up with a whole new perspective. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we truly are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today we're going to hear from a 96-year-old survivor of the Battle of the Bulge, as well as a little bit from his wife of 75 years. But before we get to Phil Wright's story, I want to take at least a moment to recognize the significance of this weekend and the 20th anniversary of the tragic events of September 11th, 2001. What happened in that field in Pennsylvania, at the Pentagon, and of course at the World Trade Center, is something that none of us who were alive for that will ever forget. It's very similar in that regard to the folks we hear from on this program, remembering December 7th, 1941, and the attack on Pearl Harbor. We all recall where we were and how we found out. A couple of thoughts on that front before we dive in with our World War II veteran guest today. First, since it's been 20 years, there are probably some younger people in your life who weren't born yet when the rest of us had our world rocked so violently 20 years ago. How about taking a few minutes this weekend to share your memories with them and explain in your words why September 11th, 2001 is a date we should never forget? And while you're at it, try to remember the spirit that arose in this country in the days that followed, how we saw the lines of division dissipating, the resolve that emerged, and of course the unity that was fostered throughout our nation. The veteran we have the privilege of visiting with today is Phil Wright of Madera Ranchos, California. That's quite a ways from where he grew up. But thanks to his Army service in World War II, nearly two decades more in the Air Force during the era of the Korean War, the Cold War, and the Vietnam War, really he's lived all over the world. We're going to hear what he remembers about the Battle of the Bulge, how he met his wife of 75 years, Hazel, and even how he ended up on a few joyrides with the legendary ace Chuck Yeager. But as always, we want to start out with the early years. So what do you remember about your childhood back east, Phil?
Well, the simple life. I had four brothers and a sister. My dad was an alcoholic. He drove a truck. It seemed like he was in a wreck every week. So we had an average childhood.
How'd you get along with all those siblings?
We got along well. I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, in a town called Elkton, E-L-K-T-O-N. Our childhood was very simple.
Did you have a lot of chores around the house?
We always had chores. We had chores that lasted from the time we got home from school until our dad got home. He didn't want us playing very much with the other kids. He wanted us doing something around the house. My dad always made sure we had enough chores to do.
Do you remember as a boy having some hopes, some dreams, some ambitions of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do?
No, I didn't. I just grew up as an average child and didn't have any ambitions at that time. I had an average childhood, except for the whippings that I got every day. My dad whipped us every day with a razor strap. Every day. When he got home, that was the first thing he did, was whipped us with a razor strap, whether you deserved it or not. He would say he was going to give us a whipping just in case he heard something.
That had to be a pretty difficult reality to live with.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Because you didn't know what he was with. He would tell you he had heard that day. Since he was an alcoholic.
Did that make you want to get out of the house?
Wanted me make me leave home, and I did. I guess I was 17. I just finished high school.
Well, and there was something that happened while you were in high school that everybody around your age I seem to talk to usually has a memory about December 7th, 1941, and the attack on Pearl Harbor and how they found out about it. Do you remember what you were doing or how you found out?
Well, very soon after that, I was drafted into the Army.
And how'd you feel about going into the Army?
Well, I had no feelings about it. It was the thing everybody was doing, so it was just normal. I had friends in the service before I was drafted.
And what did they do with you?
Camp Lee, Virginia is where I did my early time in the service.
What do you remember about that? Were there some challenging aspects of that?
Well, there was always challenges, but the life in the service was good then.
Was it eye-opening at all? Did you start to get exposed to some things you hadn't been exposed to before?
Oh, I'd never been exposed to life like that. So it was different, but it didn't take long to get adjusted to the Army life.
So from Camp Lee, where'd you go from there?
Waycross, Georgia. We went on maneuvers in Georgia in the swamps. It's pretty damp down there.
I'm sure there's no bugs or anything, though, right?
Oh, they were all over the place.
Had you ever fired any kind of weapon before?
Nothing, other than a shotgun. You know, we used to go hunting for rabbits and squirrels.
So what all did they train you on in the Army?
Well, they just gave us an M1 rifle and got us trained on the rifle range. I think everybody that was in our squadron was from the state of Virginia and had been used to guns and so forth. So we had no problems firing rifles and qualifying and to be a marksman or whatever it was we were training for.
And how did you feel about the prospect of getting sent overseas? Because this war's been going on for a couple of years now. It's still going on. How did you feel about that idea of you going across the pond?
It didn't bother me at all. I sort of enjoyed going overseas at the time.
I'm curious. You go overseas. Had you ever been on a ship before that?
Oh, no. No, I'd never been on water before.
So what was that like?
Well, it was a big ship, you know, a troop ship, a lot of people on it. I got off the ship, I was overseas.
Did you get seasick at all along the way?
I never got seasick. Nope, didn't bother me at all.
So they put you in the 567th AAA Anti-Aircraft Artillery. What was your job?
My job when I was on the gun was I transferred ammunition from the boxes to the guns.
And what kind of guns were those?
And quad 50s and 40mm anti-aircraft gun.
So the idea is if German planes are heading toward your position, you guys are going to hop on those guns and try to shoot them down.
Yeah, we did.
And where were you?
Le Havre, France. And from there, I don't know where all I went. I was all over Europe at that time. We transferred from one job to another with anti-aircraft guns. We were either protecting ammunition dumps, aircraft. We did all kinds of jobs.
And I believe you got there at winter time, right?
Yes, we did. It was very cold.
So everybody's heard about the Battle of the Bulge and how cold it was.
Yeah, I was in the Battle of the Bulge. I was in Bastogne, Belgium during that time.
One of the absolute worst places to be.
You're absolutely right. It was bad. When we were in Bastogne, Belgium, we lived in a foxhole. We did not live in a house. We were always in a foxhole, something we dug ourselves and stayed underground.
And I can't imagine it was very easy to dig that foxhole given how frozen the ground was.
That's right. It was pretty cold, pretty frozen. But we survived okay.
Can you put in perspective for us how cold it really was?
No, not really, but it was so cold. We wrapped our feet in a blanket or strips of blankets to keep warm. That was the way we kept warm during the winter time.
And I've heard some horror stories about what guys went through in those conditions. Their feet would get wet if they weren't able to change their socks. Their feet would freeze.
Yeah.
Did you deal with any of that?
I did not have to deal with any of that. I was pretty fortunate there.
So you never got any frostbite on your fingers or your toes?
No, never got any frostbite. We always stayed warm.
I thought I remembered you telling me that your big toe turned black at one point.
Well, it froze. What that? Everybody's toes froze.
See, for us, that's a big deal. That's never happened to us. But
yeah, I guess so.
So does that go numb or is it painful?
It was then. Not now. I've gotten over all of that. We were freezing and we got very little food. We got enough to survive on, but it was tough during those days. We always hoped for the best, but you never knew what was going to happen. You know, we were just GIs in the Army at that time. We survived it all.
And when you're in a foxhole, and you know there's Germans not too far away, whose artillery might be coming in on you at any minute, and you're a teenager, and you're on the other side of the world from home, what do you think about in that foxhole?
Your girl's back home. You're just waiting for your next letter from home. Hazel and I were writing to each other.
If I try to imagine myself in your shoes, in Bastogne, during the Bulge, living in a foxhole with not a whole lot to keep warm, knowing the enemy's out there, I might be a little frightened, a little scared. How about you?
Well, I think we were all scared at that time. They were always bombarding us with anti-aircraft with artillery. So we got used to it.
Were those the infamous 88s?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You could see the 88s flying through the air. That's a pretty big shell.
I've talked to a lot of veterans who have told me, too, that they still have nightmares about the sound of those 88s.
Yeah, they had a different sound all of their own, and you knew when it was coming in because you could hear it, and you knew exactly what it was, the 88s. They were pretty powerful.
Yeah, that was my next question. Did you witness some of the destruction that they could achieve with those?
Oh, yeah. They'd knock buildings down, you know, with those 88s. But I was usually in the country, though. I wasn't in towns very much. Very rarely was in a town. We were always out in the country somewhere.
How close did enemy artillery come to you?
Oh, within rifle distance. I was fired at, and I fired at them.
Got your attention, huh?
All the time.
And you mentioned earlier when I asked you about, you know, what you guys had as your anti-aircraft guns, and you said you had the 40 millimeters and the quad 50s. And I said, well, and then, you know, the planes would come in and you'd shoot at them. You said, yeah, that's what we did. Do you have some specific memories of some of those incidents where German planes are coming in and you guys are trying to shoot them down?
Oh, yeah. We had that every day.
Help me understand what that's like. What does it take to be successful in shooting down one of those German fighters?
Well, it's mostly luck.
How many men are on that gun?
Six. Six men was on a 40 millimeter cannon and quad 50s. One person was on the quad 50s, and there was about six men on a 40 millimeter anti-aircraft gun.
So help me understand what you're doing in that situation. If you know there's incoming aircraft and you guys are scrambling to be able to shoot it down, what are you doing at each moment along the way?
Passing ammunition. That's all we were doing. From our foxholes, we would go out and pick up ammunition and take it to the anti-aircraft guns and try to get back to safety again.
And I imagine those planes that are coming in are letting a few things fly too, huh?
Oh, yeah. They were all trying to kill us, but most of us survived it. We had a few people who got killed, not too many.
Were any of those people who you had gotten to know?
Oh, yeah. I knew a lot of people that were killed. There was a lot of people I knew when I was in the service that were friends of mine as civilians.
I don't want to try to make you talk about anything you're not comfortable talking about, but one of the things that's happening right now is there's a group of volunteers across the country who are trying to come up with a biography, a story to tell for every one of the 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. So they're looking for information about, you know, individual names and anything that anybody knows about them. And you said you knew a lot of guys who didn't come home. Do you remember any of their names?
Only one, really. His name was Mott Roberts, and he was killed. But most of us survived.
What happened to him?
He got hit with a mortar. He was in a foxhole, and it hit him right head on, so he didn't last but a moment, and he was gone. The majority of the people in my organization were from the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, so we knew the majority of the people in our organization from kids. We grew up together.
How well did you know Mott Roberts?
Mott Roberts, I only got to know him after we got in the service. He was from Roanoke, Virginia. He was a good guy. He got killed during the war.
And I'm just, again, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. And guys like Mott Roberts are getting killed pretty much in the same position as you are, in a foxhole. It could happen to anybody at any time.
Anytime.
How did you process that as a teenager? How did you endure that reality that something like that could happen to you?
Well, you just hoped you had your foxhole at a place where it didn't hit you.
So I'm taking inventory here of some of the things that you've shared so far that could have taken you out, that could have killed or injured you.
Oh, yeah.
We've got the 88s, mortar shells, the weather, that could have gotten you. What else? What else did you have to be concerned with that could end your life?
Well, anti-aircraft, or rather artillery. We were continually bombarded with artillery from the Germans.
And what about their aircraft? Were their bombers ever targeting you guys?
We were targeted all the time.
The time right now is break time, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old Phil Wright of Madera Ranchos, California. What does he remember about the end of the war in Europe? And what's the real story behind his 75 years of marriage? We may need his wife Hazel's help on that one. You can find photos of the Wrights then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down. 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes. From the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner. Or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number 800-989-1139.